Welcome to another edition of The Realist Report. This is your host, John Friend. Today is Saturday, May 13th, 2023. Of course, my website is therealistreport.com, where you will find an extensive archive of these podcasts, as well as other programs I participate in. You will also find all of my blog posts and articles, my Twitter feed, which is embedded in the right-hand sidebar of the website, a contact page, and many other useful and important links. I am on Twitter and Gab at Realist Report, and you can find me on Telegram at t.me/TheRealistReport. I am a regular reporter for American Free Press, America's last real newspaper, and I also contribute to and help edit the Barnes Review, a bi-monthly revisionist history magazine. Please do subscribe to these fine print publications if you are not already. Check out AmericanFreePress.net and BarnesReview.org for all the details. And today I'm joined by Riley Wagaman, an independent journalist and geopolitical commentator who maintains one of the most interesting Substack pages covering Russia and its special military operation in Ukraine. All right, Riley Wagaman, welcome to the program, sir. How are you today?
I'm doing very well, John. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, no, thanks a lot for coming on. I appreciate it. I've been following your work, as I mentioned shortly before we started here, for probably just under a year. You maintain an excellent Substack page, and am I pronouncing this correctly? You write under the alias Edward Slavsquat on Substack, is that right?
That's correct. Yes.
Okay, yeah, I thought I was pronouncing that correctly. But your name is Riley Wagaman, and you have, like I said, one of the most interesting Substack pages that I've come across covering political developments in Russia and the broader geopolitical landscape. And, of course, you also focus on the special military operation that Russia initiated against Ukraine back in February of 2022. And I also follow you on Twitter and Telegram. And I will have links for your Substack page as well as your Twitter and Telegram channels for people to check out when I post this podcast program. So to get started, can you just tell us about yourself? I know you're a former writer for Russia Today, which is one of the largest English language Russian news outlets in the world. And I think you also contributed to Press TV, which is an English language Iranian news outlet. But you're born in America, correct? Maybe you can just kind of start out, tell us a little bit about your background and how you got involved in journalism.
Yeah, I'm originally from Los Angeles, actually, but my family moved to the East Coast when I was a teenager, and I started writing when I was in college. Actually, it's funny just to think about it, but actually one of my first writing gigs was I was an unpaid contributor to Huffington Post College. You know, this was like back when the Huffington Post was this like big up and coming thing. And I had some friends who were working in media, and they're like, oh, you should get this Riley Gatteray for you. It was really fun. So that was like one of my first writing gigs, like the horrible, degenerate Huffington Post. But you got to start.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't know if you should be bragging about that. But like you said, I guess you got to start somewhere. No, that's cool. That's an interesting experience.
Yeah, so I ended up in Washington, D.C., and within a year, I was totally burnt out. It really is a cesspool. And the worst part about writing in Washington, D.C., and I was focusing on U.S. politics back then, is that there's just no, in my opinion, it's just a horse race for these people. And so there's never any attempt to, like, even if you pick a side, like Democrat or Republican, it's basically just a circle jerk. You know, like you never actually hold your own side accountable for anything. And so it's just this revolving wheel of it's just this sort of positive feedback loop of suckiness, you know, and it's very, very cynical place, very dark place. And so within a year, I was done and I moved to Central Europe. Actually, I was in the Czech Republic for about a year and then I just kept heading east and I ended up in Russia, just total fluke with no real idea of why I was there. You know, a lot of people come to Russia for political reasons or because for religious reasons, etc. I just basically went to Russia because I was bored, you know. And
wow, that's interesting.
Yeah, So when I got there, though, it was just really eye-opening. I mean, it's such a fascinating, beautiful, interesting country. And yeah, and I sort of the thing that was really funny about it was that when I arrived in Russia, I'm like, I'm in Russia. And at the time I was in Bashkortostan, which is a republic in Russia. It's in the southern Ural region. Like it's pretty far out there. Most foreigners never reach Bashkortostan. And I was like, I'm so glad I'm in Russia now. I can escape politics. No one will ever bother me again. And literally like a month later, my dawn happened. You know, and then like everything just went crazy. And this was also around when Edward Snowden arrived in Russia. And so, I mean, it's hard to remember, but if you go back to 2013, Russia really wasn't on anyone's radar. And then just suddenly over a period of a few months, it became like the big enemy, or, you know, it just started getting headline news, and it never really stopped after that. So,
yeah, I remember it. Yeah.
So, yeah, anyway, and like since I was in Russia, I was like, well, you know, I guess I should start writing again since now Russia is relevant. So I moved to Moscow, and yeah, I ended up writing for several outlets, including I was the Moscow correspondent for Press TV, which is Iran State TV. And also I actually ended up at RT for several years working for their website. So anyway, it's been
What was it like, you know, writing and working with both of those organizations that are obviously pretty big, legitimate, relatively well-funded compared to, you know, maintaining a Substack website or something like that? You know what I mean? Like, they're pretty legitimate news outlets. What was your experience working with both RT and Press TV?
Look, I mean, for the most part, first of all, Press TV was awesome. Like, super, I have to say, all the Iranians I worked with, like all of my editors who were in Tehran, were the coolest guys ever. The thing about Press TV, the problem was that because of sanctions, they couldn't get money into Russia, like, easily. So what would end up happening is that I would get paid, like, every 3 months, and I would just get a random phone call from some Iranian guy being like, we're in some random bank in Germany, and we're going to transfer money now. Like, give us your account details again. Or I had a cameraman who worked with me in Press TV, sort of a producer, who would just get like bags of euros from the Iranian embassy. It was just like wild.
No kidding. Wow. Yeah, that's pretty interesting.
Hey, Iranians, friendliest people on earth. I love Iran. But
have you been? Did you visit Iran?
You know what? One of my biggest regrets in life is that while I was with Press TV, I never got to Iran, but I desperately want to go. I hear it's amazing. Everyone who goes says it's awesome.
Right. So you had a good experience with Press TV. It was just a little bit, sounds like a little bit difficult maintaining the relationship, you know, just logistically with, you know, trying to get paid and that sort of thing. So did you leave on good terms, or like how did that work out?
Yeah, I left just for personal reasons. I just couldn't do it anymore because of personal issues and family obligations and so forth. But and then after that, though, I did end up at RT, and RT, you know, I have mixed feelings about it. I mean, I had a lot of really talented coworkers. And the problem with RT, though, is that if you want to write anything interesting about Russia, you can't do it, right? Because look, RT is just it's Russia's voice of America, right? So it's a good place if you want to dunk on the West, but if you want to write anything meaningful about Russia, that's not the place to do it, right? And so when COVID came and, you know, like they started implementing QR codes in Moscow, RT would just ignore it or defend it, which to me was totally unacceptable. And the worst part about that is that RT would give platforms to Westerners to call out the COVID totalitarianism in the West, and then they would just either ignore or defend the same policies inside Russia, which to me is totally unacceptable.
Like, yeah, that's interesting, because that has been – I mean, that's actually really how I discovered your Substack in the first place, was your coverage of, you know, the Russian government's response to quote unquote COVID, which I'm not even convinced was ever even really a thing. I think it was basically just one big global psyop, essentially. And we can talk about that later on in the program, and maybe you wouldn't necessarily agree with that, but I know you've been very critical of the Russian government's response to COVID and some of the tyrannical measures that they've implemented. And you're right. I mean, these are things that most people in the West wouldn't even know about. I mean, they, you know, this sort of thing doesn't get a lot of coverage. And RT, like you said, isn't going to cover it. They're going to criticize the tyrannical response that we see in America and in Europe, but they're not going to really provide any objective coverage or critique of what was going on in Russia, right? That's basically been your experience with it.
Yeah, absolutely. And to add to that, though, John, the real cynicism here was that so an RT International, which is what Westerners are going to read because it's in English, you know, they give the platform to Westerners to call out the COVID tyranny in the West. They ignore really the stuff going on in Russia. But then if you read RT in Russian, like Russian language RT, they're saying, like, you know, masks are good. Anyone who opposes vaccines is some sort of freak and anti-science. In fact, Margarita Simonyan, who is the RT's editor-in-chief, she made a documentary called Enemies of the People, which is an old Stalinist term. Like, that was the phrase they used when they were basically liquidating, you know, people who were opposed to, you know, the Soviet regime. And
Right.
she labeled all these prominent anti-vax activists in Russia as enemies of the people. This was a RT state-funded documentary where they smeared all these people who were just saying, look, it's ridiculous to coerce people into getting an experimental genetic injection that has no proven safety or efficacy.
Right. Oh yeah, that was very common in America, as I'm sure you know, but it was also taking place in Russia. Yeah, that's interesting. It's almost like Russia has its own sort of deep state connected to the World Economic Forum and the WHO and this sort of like medical tyranny that we saw roll out in you know early 2020. It was really like a global phenomenon. It's really amazing, actually.
Yeah, it was scary. And you know, I'll
Yeah.
tell you, I really didn't, me at the time, I guess I was much more naive and doe-eyed. I really thought that, and there were in the beginning, there were sort of signs that maybe Russia would not go along with it. And I really in my heart felt like, look at this stupid West, like basically shooting itself in the foot with this ridiculous pandemic, so-called pandemic. Russia will never go along with this bullshit. And then it did.
Yeah, that's interesting, yeah. And I've heard different things. I remember listening to an interview with a guy named Charles Bausman, who's an American that moved over to Russia. Are you familiar with him?
Yeah, we're friends.
Okay,
I
yeah.
talked to
Okay, yeah, I've never actually talked to him, but I remember hearing an interview that he did. This would have been at least a year ago, probably even longer than that, where he was basically saying that sort of defending Russia as like sort of not going along with the, you know, the way the West and America responded to COVID, and saying how although in some cases like local authorities like in Moscow, for example, like the mayor or like maybe like a lower level government would attempt to implement face masks or you know mandatory vaccines, but like he was basically arguing that like no one really ever went along with it, and I don't know how true that is or what you would and maybe I'm not even totally accurately characterizing what he said, but basically his main point was that Russia wasn't really going along with this COVID agenda in the same way that the West was. But reading your website, it seems like there's a lot of at least you know segments within the Russian political landscape that are in fact like totally on board with this COVID tyranny.
Yeah, look, the Russian bureaucrats and the Russian government were 100% on board with it. The non-enforcement came at just the basic local level where Russians didn't want to play along. Or if you're a cashier in some supermarket, you're not going to waste your time trying to convince people to, you know, social distance while they're waiting to pay for their groceries because no one bought into it. Look, the big takeaway, though, from whether Russia went along with it or not, I mean, first of all, I think there's an overwhelming evidence that it did, but the biggest you know, bullet point that I would give here is Russia in 2021 suffered a population decline that has not been seen since the end of World War II, a staggering loss of life of more than a million people. So how would that be possible if many people, I mean, I am sort of working under the assumption, just from my own research, that COVID really wasn't a threat. And what COVID is exactly is maybe up for debate. But as far as I'm concerned, COVID is a positive PCR test. So my question is, how do you suffer this catastrophic loss of life if Russia isn't going along with it? And I'll tell you one of the main reasons. You could point to possible vaccine-related deaths, but honestly, one of the biggest and a truly horrendous crime is that Russia across the country suspended routine medical care. They restricted hospitals to people. They completely reworked the entire medical system so that people with alleged COVID got priority, and left people with very serious health issues to basically just rot in the street, or they just got second-rate care, or they had to wait.
Yeah, that was similar. That sort of thing was also happening here as well, and probably many other countries. Yeah, that was a very common feature of all this.
So it really was a very serious crime, you know, against the Russian people. And the same crime has been committed on a global scale, like you said.
Yeah.
So I don't think Russia is special in this case, unfortunately.
Yeah. No, that's interesting. Yeah, and we'll definitely talk a little bit more about that, you know, as we proceed here. Well, I wanted to ask you – well, you kind of actually mentioned it. You really didn't have, like, you know, a major connection to Russia. Is your family background Russian or, like, Eastern European or anything? Like, what drew you to Russia, or was it just really – just curiosity, and you were just in Europe and just kept traveling and ended up in Russia?
Yeah, that's basically what happened. I was in Moravia in southern Czech Republic, and I just decided one day, actually I didn't decide, it was because my visa was about to expire. So I was like, I gotta go somewhere, where should I go? And I just, by total coincidence, I just found this teaching job in Bashkortostan. I'd never heard of Bashkortostan, of course. So first I had to look up where it was. I was like, oh, it's in Russia. Interesting. So I just emailed them. I was like, hey, listen, I'm this guy in the Czech Republic, and I'll teach English for you. I'm like, oh, great. Like, we'll write you an invitation and get your visa and come. So that's what happened.
Wow. That's really cool.
Yeah.
How would you describe your political views? And do you still follow American politics at all or closely, or do you like, are you able to like vote in our elections, or do you even bother?
Yeah, that's a good question. I've never voted in a U.S. election. Actually, the only politician I ever gave money to in the United States was Mike Gravel. Do you know who Mike Gravel is?
Yeah, yeah, I remember. He was the guy from Alaska, right?
Yeah, he was.
Yeah.
He was
anti-war, like kind of like more progressive, right?
Yeah, I guess he probably was progressive, but the cool thing about Gravel is that they actually let him debate like one time, I think in 2008, and he like called out Obama and Hillary and all these other jokers, and I thought it was so awesome. So I gave him $15. I think I got a T-shirt or something. But,
oh wow, that's cool. Yeah. Well, how would you describe your political views like overall if you had to just like sort of explain it in like a nutshell to somebody?
I mean I honestly don't know. I just don't know if there's even, first of all, I'm just hyper suspicious of authority at this point on all levels, which maybe is even unhealthy at this point, but I don't know John. I mean I would have to say that since I arrived in Russia, I'm definitely way more socially conservative. I'm pretty much just assumed that everything is going to get worse, and this sort of this obsession with progress, I think is going to doom us basically. Mm. Maybe I'm a
interesting. Okay.
Maybe I'm a Luddite. That's what I'll my political. I think we should go back to the telegrams and carrier pigeons and I don't know.
Yeah. I don't know. Yeah, technology has definitely caused some problems. I mean, there's a lot of benefits, you know, with modern technology, but there's also a lot of problems associated with it. And it's sort of tough striking that balancing act. But no, that's interesting. I was just curious if you were, I knew that you were like obviously very critical of America's political establishment, probably, both the Republicans and Democrats. I mean, that's anybody that's thinking objectively and critically and looking at American politics would have to come to that conclusion. And I totally agree with you. I'm very skeptical of any authority anywhere, just given the nature of what's happened the past couple of years with COVID. But I mean, even prior to that, I've been very skeptical of mainstream politics and certainly the mass media for a very long time, going back to when I was in college. In fact, my first political candidate that I was interested in was actually Ralph Nader back in 2008 when he was
Oh, wow.
running. Yeah, he was running as an independent, and yeah, I mean, he was talking about all the important issues, and I'm like, why is this like random like independent third party guy like talking about everything that matters and nobody else is. So I kind of like saw through politics very, very quickly, like at an early age. And that sort of suspicion and skepticism has only grown the more that I learn, and the more I learn about history and just see what's going on in modern America. It's just totally out of control. So anyways, I want to move on here and talk a little bit about Russia, because you hear like American pundits and politicians denounce Russia as this like backwards country. Like you hear like I remember like John McCain, for example, when he was still alive, he would describe Russia as a gas station masquerading as a country.
Yeah.
And we've seen like this over the top demonization of Russian President Putin for going back to 2014. I mean, I remember watching Bill O'Reilly. He did this whole segment about how Putin is the new Hitler. And
Yeah.
you hear stuff like that like a lot, like in mainstream politics and from mainstream like American politicians. But I'm curious, like what is it like living in Russia, and like what are your thoughts of Putin and Russia's like political leadership in general?
Look, it will really depend on who you ask in Russia about like Putin and the political system. I'd honestly say that a lot of Russians are sort of apolitical, just in the sense that they're just so jaded from a very long history of having governments and even entire sort of socioeconomic systems collapse under their feet, to the point where they'll argue about it amongst themselves or speculate. But at the end of the day, I don't think they take politics nearly as seriously as Americans. Like Americans will stop talking to each other if, a family member is a Democrat and the other is a Republican, right?
Yeah.
But it's just not like that in Russia at all. In fact, one of the coolest, I'll tell you a little story. One of the first, this is true, one of the first conversations I had when I moved to Moscow, I met this guy. And my Russian wasn't very good, so I wish I only understood like 70% of what he was saying. But we were just sitting at a table and drinking, and he's like, "Oh, you're an American. Did you know that the are you familiar, John, with the it's called like the Kursk the Kursk? It was this nuclear submarine that sank." Yeah, so he's like, "Did you know that when the Kursk sank, Russia and all of these Western intelligence agencies took the nuclear missiles from the Kursk and used it to demolish the World Trade Center?" I'm like, "Oh."
Oh, I remember reading about there was a Russian guy who, yeah, made that claim, like had this whole theory about it, yeah.
But like this is just how Russians talk. They just love sort of throwing it out there, just like with total strangers even, which I love so
That's
much.
awesome.
Yeah, it really is. It's very refreshing, and sort of you just don't feel like you're gonna like no one's breathing down your neck. You can just like put something out there and people are like, "Ah, yeah, that's interesting," or whatever. Anyway, that's how I'll really describe the political climate. And I would say a lot of this, there is probably still popular support for Putin, but I would have to put a little asterisk to that and to say that I really do feel as if it's sort of out of pragmatism, because there really is no one to replace Putin. And in a way, Putin is sort of a czar-like figure, I say that meaning not because I think he actually has czar-like powers. I don't actually believe that. But it's because he somehow has transcended politics in Russia. Like, whenever anything goes wrong, no one actually blames Putin. They blame his cabinet or the people under, like, governors or sort of lower level or officials or sort of mid-management, right? And so for them, it's sort of – it's honestly, in a lot of ways, it's sort of like the monarchy in the UK, where you have the king and the queen, for better or worse. And but you're not really supposed to criticize them. You're supposed to – and they don't really have a lot of power, but, you know, everybody rages against the prime minister and parliament, et cetera, et cetera. Like, everybody in Russia hates the state Duma, the Russian parliament. Everybody thinks they're crooks and scoundrels and useless low lives. But nobody really goes after Putin that much. So it's just an interesting sort of – it's not even a political dynamic, but more of a social one, I would say, you know, where
right.
Putin –
that's interesting. Okay.
He sort of represents this idea of stability, you know, and like for example, every New Year's Eve, right, Putin gives this little address on TV. And it's just tradition, whether you like him or not, you have to, like, sit up by your TV and listen to Putin, you know, wish you a happy new year, right? So I think there is a lot of this with Russia. And look, I mean, whether you like – whatever you think of Putin, the reality is that he represents what I would say some sort of restoration of Russian, like, self-identity and pride that was very seriously lacking under the Yeltsin era, you know?
Like the immediate aftermath of the collapse of the Soviet Union.
Exactly.
Yeah. No, that's I've heard that before. That's a very common theme when looking at Russian, you know, politics, you know, in the aftermath of the collapse of the Soviet Union. Well, and I mean, the whole country went through major turmoil. All the state-owned institutions were looted by these corrupt oligarchs, many of whom had ties directly to America. I mean, the Americans were over there, quote unquote, advising all of this and, like, overseeing this massive criminal spree, right?
Yep, exactly.
So, that's interesting. And I do have a couple other questions about Putin, but I want to ask just real quick, because I know you lived in Eastern Europe, you moved to Russia, you've lived in Russia for quite a while, you lived in Moscow. What about now? Because now you live in Georgia, right? Which is just
now
south. Tbilisi. Am I pronouncing that correctly? Tbilisi.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. And that's in Georgia, which is a totally separate country, obviously. But Georgia was part of the Soviet Union, though, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it's more like I said Central Asia. I don't know if that's totally accurate, but it's basically like just directly south of Russia, like south of Moscow, right?
It's not exactly directly south of Moscow, but it's not. I mean, if you take a bus, it'll take about 24 hours to get here, basically. I think it's like I don't know the exact distance.
Okay. Yeah. Let me just pull up the map really quick. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. No, you're right. It's a little bit like south and a little bit east. Boy, man, Russia is huge. Go look at a map of Russia, guys. Like, if you haven't done it, it is incredible how big of a country Russia is. So what's it like living in Georgia, and how long have you been living there?
I've almost been here a year, actually, which is hard to – actually, really, time really flew here. I was – and to be honest, the original plan was to get a new visa and go back to Russia, but – just strange complications. So I actually ended up staying here, and it's a very interesting country.
It looks like it, yeah. Just looking at like photos of it, like, and it's a pretty big city too, right? It's an old city.
It's a very old city. It's not so big though. It's about 1 million people, but
okay.
it's a very interesting country. A very ancient culture. Really beautiful churches and old castles and just some amazing places to visit. I wouldn't say it's my favorite country in the world, but I would definitely recommend a visit to Georgia. It's a cool place.
Yeah. Now, and so you really haven't been too many other places like in Eastern Europe or Central Asia. It's pretty much been either in Russia itself or in Georgia. Like, have you been to like any of the surrounding countries like Armenia, Azerbaijan, or like any countries, or, you know, in Central Asia?
Yeah, I've only spent a, I spent a day in Armenia. Armenia was cool. I spent spent about a day in Kazakhstan, which was interesting. Turkey. Yeah, but nothing long term. I mean, yeah, I've traveled a lot too in Europe, of course, but yeah, nothing really sort of permanent where I could give some sort of deep thoughts.
Analysis, yeah. Well, I got to ask you, what's the standard of living like? Like in Russia itself and then in some of these other countries, is it pretty, you know, comparable to America, or is it, you know, there's still much more like development that needs to be done to get kind of caught up, or just in general, what's it like living there?
Well, if you're in a major city, especially Moscow, it has a very many people, I would say, not all, but live a very, I would say, I guess what you would call a Western standard of living. I mean, very, very developed. I mean, it's a very, very developed city, excellent infrastructure, very clean. In many ways, Moscow is a very cool city. It really is. I really wouldn't recommend people living there at this point, just because it's run by this insane technocrat named Sergei Sobyanin. But that's sort of a different topic. But it's a very beautiful, clean city with excellent modern infrastructure. And St. Petersburg is also extremely cool, very, very beautiful. Also, I would say on average, a very respectable standard of living. And also, you know, cities like Kazan, which is in Tatarstan, I can't speak to other ones, but I would say any of the large cities in Russia, you'll find like a decent standard of living. The reality, though, is that once you get out to the boonies, just like in the United States, you're going to find a lot of poverty. You really will. And the living conditions in many sort of, you know, if you drive just a few hours outside of Moscow, you can already see it very clearly. So in that respect, it's not so different from the United States, right?
Where you have
these concentrations of extreme wealth and comfort. And then you have a large swath of the country that are really living in deplorable states. And the same is true of Russia. Absolutely.
Yeah, no, I could totally see that. So let's just to kind of get back to Putin. I just want to briefly say this. I mean, he's obviously been this major figure in Russian politics for over two decades now, right? I mean, I think he first came at, what was it, 99? I think he came into office. Either 99 or like early 2000. So it's been like over two decades now, and you know, some dissidents in the West denounce him as some sort of puppet. You know, he's working with the Jews, or he's working with the World Economic Forum, or he's like some subversive force in Russia due to his background in the KGB and Russian intelligence. And then on the other hand, you have like the mainstream mass media, which, you know, as I mentioned, they're comparing him to Hitler, and he's like this tyrant. You know, he's this bloodthirsty war criminal for starting this conflict in Ukraine. And then, you know, previously, you know, there's been other wars that he's been involved with, you know, in the Chechen region, and you know, there's been other conflicts in general. So they portray him as this bloodthirsty monster, basically this war criminal, and you know, attempting to rebuild and resurrect the Russian Empire, something like that. I mean, what's the real deal? Like, is it, you sort of address this a little bit. I mean, is he sort of just like a? He's to me, he seems like a very genuine, sincere statesman, like in the truest sense of the word. Like, he really does care about the Russian people and the Russian, you know, the country, and wants to see, you know, the Russian people and the Russian country flourish. That's my just sort of impression. I could be wrong on that, but that's sort of my takeaway. What's the real deal with Putin in your view?
Yeah, you know, Putin is such an enigma, and I think that what you just said about him, I think there's a lot of evidence to suggest everything that you just said about him, that he genuinely cares about the Russian people and seems like a adept statesman. I think there's a lot of evidence to, you know, you can definitely make that case. You know, the bizarre thing about Putin is that he talks a good talk, and then for some reason, nothing he talks about ever actually happens, right? Like,
oh,
for
it's,
example,
it's sort of like an American politician that's still in the headlines today, President Trump, former President Trump.
In 2022, Russia just recorded its fifth straight year of population decline. You know, and so I point that out because, you know, Putin, almost every chance he gets on the podium, he talks about how, you know, the West has abandoned family values and it's like this degenerate tranny state, which, by the way, is true. But,
yeah, exactly.
But it's like, well, okay, and why is Russia's divorce rate so high? Why does it have a very, very high rate of abortion? Why is it bleeding people? And why are you, you know, to make up for this, importing Central Asians? And so it's just, you know, what I would compare it to? It's sort of like, I think that disaffected Westerners who are genuinely just tired and pissed off at their own governments hear Putin, and he makes a lot of sense, and he's making very valid criticisms directed at their own governments. And they say, wow, this guy, I wish this guy was in charge. He's awesome. But then think about like some sort of, you know, citizen of the Soviet Union looking to Ronald Reagan and be like, wow, this Ronald Reagan guy is so cool. He talked about freedom and democracy. And, you know, it's just like, well, yeah, but it's still the United States and they don't care about freedom and democracy at all. Right. And so that's what I would say. I mean, I think there is a level of where you know, it's part of this sort of, in my opinion, this sort of false binary or false dichotomy where you know, if you are anti, you're either pro-West or pro-Russia. And, you know, Putin is not the savior of the West. He's a Russian politician, right? Like, I don't, in my opinion, it doesn't make any sense to look to Putin for answers in your own country. He has enough problems at home in Russia, you know? And actually, you know what? My biggest criticism of Putin is that I think he's a liberal and a normie. I think that.
Yeah, I've heard that. Well, see, and I don't follow all like the insider baseball of Russian politics. I mean, it's hard enough even staying up with what's going on in American politics, let alone Russian politics. But from what I've read and heard, there's actually like a very like more right wing, like nationalistic faction in Russian politics that's much more to the right and hardcore than Putin is. So it's kind of funny, like the way Putin's portrayed as like this, you know, right wing tyrant, like dictator, like, you know, hell bent on taking over the world or something. When in reality, he's really for years, and I mean, there's a lot of evidence of this, where for years, I mean, ever since he's really been in office, he has been doing everything in his power to sort of placate the West and to play nice with the West and to, you know, get on board with this, you know, sort of globalist type, you know, thinking in the West. And we've just consistently like disrespected him and, you know, just trying to put Russia down essentially. And of course, that's the neocons running the United States, not really, you know, anything to do with the American people or what the American people want. But yeah, I tend to, at least from what I've read, it seems like, you know, that is the case. Like Putin is really not this like hardcore nationalist type figure. He's more of a liberal, you know, I think you could probably say nationalist to it, or maybe populist is a better word. Like he does genuinely seem like he cares about the interests of the Russian people, you know, but he's not like this hardcore, like right wing figure, right?
Oh yeah, no, not at all. And that's really the irony of it. And you're totally right to point out how he is, you know, he's presented as this, you know, the new Hitler, this bloodthirsty monster who wants to conquer the world. Like, no, it's honestly nothing like that. I mean,
yeah.
Putin is nothing like that. And what is sort of frustrating about it, though, is that because the portrayal of Putin is so absurd and extreme, I do feel like there's this tendency, like sort of in Western alternative or independent media circles, to sort of they feel this obligation that they should defend Putin against these ridiculous accusations, which I totally get. And he should, I mean, they should be, you should push back against this bullshit. But at the same time, it's like, at a certain point, you just have to, instead of looking at him as a bloodthirsty tyrant, we should just try to just objectively assess, like, what is he actually? Okay, he's not a bloodthirsty tyrant. What is he? And the reality is, if you just look at his record, as you pointed out, I mean, he really has bent over backwards to appease the West and try to integrate Russia.
Yeah.
And be, you know, the trusted Western partners. And even to this day, Russia is pumping gas through Ukraine that goes directly to the so-called satanic West, which is funding basically Russia's destruction right now.
Yeah, it's such a weird situation. You're right. I agree. Well, I'll say this. I have been very impressed with Putin and other Russian political leaders. Probably most importantly, the foreign minister, Lavrov. You know, I've been trying to follow these guys as closely as I can, you know, especially since the launch of the special military operation. I mean, they have absolutely devastating critiques of America and this, you know, unipolar world order that the neocons running America have maintained really since the end of World War II, but especially since the collapse of the Soviet Union. And I've been very, very impressed with their just like their overall approach to diplomacy and this promotion and advocacy of like a more multipolar world order, which at least in rhetoric and based on what they're saying is centered around mutual respect and, you know, respect for the sovereignty of foreign nations and developing win-win economic arrangements. So the Russian approach, at least on the surface and in rhetoric, the Russian approach to international relations in general stands like in total contrast to the arrogant, hypocritical, and ruthless approach by the neocons running this country. You know, our approach to diplomacy is centered around threats and intimidation and outright violence. You know, we'll go invade your country if you don't do what we say. And also, on the other hand, we're also promoting these degenerate values and political ideals down the throat of the entire world. I mean, you know, we got these the homosexual agenda. I mean, you'd think that like this is like a number one issue in America. Like, you know, the way that some of these political leaders talk, you know, it's just totally crazy and asinine. But that's really the American approach to diplomacy, and it has been for a very long time. And I've been a major critic of American foreign policy really since I've become politically aware, and this is going back over 10 years now. And I frankly would much prefer to see the Russians and the Chinese develop a more mutually respectful global, multipolar system here. Because the way we've been, controlling the world and dictating to the world and invading the world is really not working out for anybody, especially the American people, not to mention the millions of people we've murdered all over the place with these, you know, ridiculous, destructive, basically, you know, wars based on total lies and deceptions, you know. So this to me is a positive development. Yeah, maybe it will end up hurting Americans, you know, our pocketbooks or, you know, whatever. But at the end of the day, I think at least in rhetoric, what the Russians and Chinese and their allies are building and developing and talking about sounds like a much better deal for everybody, frankly.
Yeah, look, first of all, I totally agree. I think that this so-called unipolar world order and Washington foreign policy has been, I mean, it's a great shame. It's despicable. It's disgusting. I don't think I was born in 1987. I think maybe one year that I've been alive, the United States hasn't been aggressively bombing or invading someone. You know, it's really shameful.
It is. It's shameful. It's embarrassing. It's disgraceful. It makes me ashamed to even claim to be an American. I mean, this is not what America's all about, but this is what these psychopaths that have hijacked our government and media have turned this country into.
Totally. I 100% agree. This is what I would say, though, not to be a party pooper, but I, you know, when it comes to this sort of a shift towards the East, let's call it that, or multipolarism. You know, Russia and China are still governed by human beings, and human beings haven't changed very much over the last 3,000 years, right? So this idea that wars will somehow end, or that with their if it comes to pass, the newfound power of Beijing and Moscow and maybe India and other countries won't be misused or maybe exploited. In my honest opinion, I think that's a little bit naive. And, you know, I remember I had this amazing conversation. I had a friend in Bashkortostan who worked for Gazprom, and we were talking about the Iraq war, and I was getting really worked up about it. I'm like, oh, I'm so embarrassed as an American, the stupid Iraq war. Like, what are we doing? We're just vaporizing innocent people for oil. And he turned to me and said, look, Riley, like, Russia would do the same thing if it could, you know? And he was saying, if the Russian state had the political capital and the sort of, you know, the military logistics or whatever you want to call it to make it happen, he's saying anyone with power would go in and snatch up oil and vaporize the peasants. Like, that's what power does. So look, maybe I'm just too cynical. Maybe I'm just too jaded. Maybe I spent too much time in Russia and all the Russians have rubbed off on me.
Well, I mean, I think you're making a valid point, obviously. And that's why I was really emphasizing, praising the rhetoric that we hear from Russia and China and the sort of world order that they're advocating for, because it is rhetoric. I mean, it sounds good. It sounds like a much more, you know, peaceful and just, you know, ordering of the world and just the way nation states interact with each other. But at the end of the day, you're right. There is that potential to be for misuse or exploitation or whatever. So, I mean, I guess we'll just have to wait and see how things play out. But at least in rhetoric, what they're saying sounds like a much better deal for everybody involved. But yeah, no, I'm skeptical. I'm skeptical of the Chinese. I'm skeptical of the Russians to a certain extent. I mean, but at least in their rhetoric and just like their overall approach, they sound much saner and much much more respectful than anything you hear coming from any political leader in Washington, D.C. That is 100% sure.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the bar is pretty low, but yeah.
No, yeah, true.
You gotta give credit where it's due. I agree.
So we definitely got to talk about this situation in Ukraine, and I want to ask you sort of a broad question. What is like your just general understanding of the conflict in Ukraine? Could you give us like the basic background details from your perspective? Like what led up to it? What are the underlying causes? Was this Russian special military operation a rational, justified response to the conflict in the Donbass?
All right. Yeah, it's a big question.
Sorry, I know that is a big question, but go ahead.
Well, look, first of all, I think it's important to, just to back up a little bit, and maybe we'll start with the Minsk agreements, which were signed. There was two of them. They were signed basically to create, it was a ceasefire, a formal ceasefire when the Ukraine crisis started. I think they were signed in 2015, if I remember correctly. And basically what the Minsk agreement said is that, you know, hostilities end and there needs to be elections in Donbass, and with the goal, the aim of reintegrating the breakaway republics of Lugansk and Donetsk back into Ukraine, but giving them some political autonomy. So it's important to remember that the Minsk agreement was not about independence, negotiating independence for Donbass. It was about reintegrating Donbass into the breakaway territories into Ukraine. And the logic behind this at the time was that Moscow calculated that because they didn't want to go to war with Ukraine, because they thought that would have disastrous consequences. The idea here was that they would try to exert soft power, because Donetsk and Lugansk were going to be voting. It's a very pro-Russia voting bloc. And so if they have this voting bloc, this sort of permanently pro-Russia voting bloc in Ukraine, this is how they can exert influence over decision making in Kiev. Right. So far, so good. And what's really bizarre is that whether, and you know, maybe we can't trust the official figures, but even if you triple them or double or triple them, I don't think it makes much of a difference. I mean, the reality is that by 2022, early 2022, there really wasn't a lot of fighting in Donbass, right? It was pretty quiet in general. I think in 2021, something like 25 civilians on both sides, both in Russia, like, you know, Lugansk and Donetsk, and as well as territories controlled by the Ukrainian military, died. And now it's like 25 civilians will die in a day, you know, from getting shelled in Donetsk, which is tragic. And I'm not trying to, you know, every civilian death is obviously tragic. But what I would say is one has to wonder if this, well, I'm sort of getting ahead of myself, but basically what I'm trying to say on that point is, unfortunately, I do believe that this conflict has exacerbated many, many of the problems that existed pre-February 24th, right? That while there are many legitimate grievances against Kiev, I don't know if this war has actually solved any of those or made them better. But anyway, sort of, I got ahead of myself there. What I would say is that, in my opinion, and this is also coming from, I follow Russian language media very, very closely, especially sort of alternative spaces, guys with military backgrounds who have been in Donbass, Igor Strelkov, who basically started the Ukraine crisis single-handedly. All of these guys basically say the same thing, which is that the special military operation really was a special military operation in the sense that it was supposed to be a very relatively quick, mostly bloodless regime change operation, where it was sort of a military psyop where they just sent tank columns from different directions, weren't expecting much resistance. Zelensky was supposed to flee. And by the way, maybe he did to Poland for a little bit, but obviously he eventually came back. And Russia would install a government that would be more friendly and brotherly towards Moscow. And possibly there was no intention of even, you know, annexing Kherson or any of these other regions, that they just wanted a government in Kiev that was not openly hostile towards them, right? So the problem, obviously, is that did not happen. And we're more than a year in, and Russia has not even accomplished what I would describe as the most tangible goal, which is pushing the Ukrainian military out of Donbass, which in my opinion is very, very odd and peculiar that the world's second largest and most powerful military for some reason can't push the Ukrainians out of Donbass. And that was a major, the protection of Donetsk and Lugansk was one of the like four talking points, the justifications given for this conflict. And it hasn't happened, right? And, you know, you can go down the list. I mean, maybe I'm sort of getting ahead of myself here, but so, you know, you look at Putin's speech on the morning of January 24th, and he gave a number of reasons for going in. He said to demilitarize and denazify Ukraine, and also to prevent Ukraine from becoming a permanent anti-Russia on Russia's border, right? Preventing, and by extension, preventing NATO expansion. And then, of course, the protection of Donbass. Well, look, I mean, you can go down that list, and I'm sorry, but Ukraine has never been more militarized than it is now. As for denazification, first of all, I don't even know what that means, frankly. And also, if you're trying to denazify it, the guys who are, you know, presented as the biggest neo-Nazis in Ukraine, the Azov Battalion, their like leader was captured at Mariupol and was released in exchange for an oligarch, Viktor Medvedchuk. You know, as far as we talked about how Donbass is still being shelled regularly, so that hasn't gone according to plan. And as far as stopping NATO expansion, I mean, Finland just joined NATO. Ukraine might join NATO this summer. Sweden is apparently possibly weeks away from joining NATO. So, as I said, unfortunately, in my opinion, you know, I think that there were legitimate reasons for some sort of action to be taken. I mean, there was Moscow had legitimate grievances against Kiev. The problem is that everything that Putin set out has accomplished everything that he set out to prevent, you know?
That's an interesting analysis. I mean, I have a hard time like disagreeing with you. That was always one thing that, and again, this was something that is never, the media's coverage of this situation is just so atrocious. And like most people wouldn't even know the first thing about this conflict. But one of the things that Putin has always talked about really from day one and even before, like well before the launch of the special military operation, is how the civilians in the Donbass region, which is the primarily ethnic Russian region of Ukraine, have been, you know, being killed by the not only the militias but also the just the outright military of Ukraine, and how that was a major reason, you know, leading up to the special military operation. But as you said, now, I mean, it's probably even worse. I mean, there's people getting killed every single day now. And where is the current like conflict at? Do you have any idea? I mean, it's so hard to get like accurate information about what's really going on there.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, and I follow it pretty closely, and it's still very, very difficult to, you know, try to actually figure out what's going on. But basically, I mean, incredibly, it appears that at least last time I checked was a few hours ago, that the Ukrainian military was actually making gains on the flanks, basically trying to flank around Bakhmut, which is where a lot of the fighting has been taking place over the last 7 or 8 months. And
that's in Donetsk, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah.
So, I mean, and obviously we're expecting some sort of Ukrainian counteroffensive, and I know that many people are very dismissive of this, but I wouldn't completely dismiss it. How successful it'll be is obviously an open question, but it does, from everything I've read and people, you know, the people inside Russia who I follow and trust are also saying, you know, this is nothing to sneeze at, right? But what I would say, just as a general observation, is that Russia has sort of exhausted itself. I don't think there's much potential for any more offensive. And in fact, they've dug in. This is openly reported and pretty well documented. I mean, Russia is not preparing for an offensive. It's digging trenches, in fact, deep into its own territory that it's captured. In fact, right on the right, you know, sort of like near even Crimea, they're digging trenches, which to me doesn't sound very promising. And I do feel like I think the best case scenario now, honestly, for Russia is some sort of frozen conflict, where the current battle line doesn't really move very much, and there's some sort of armistice or ceasefire agreed to. But unfortunately, at the political level, that I do believe that would be quite disastrous for Putin. With what has happened over the last year, I mean, Kherson, which was officially incorporated into the Russian Federation, is currently under Ukrainian territory.
So just to be clear about that, so Donetsk, Lugansk, Kherson region, and then wasn't there one more that was it was four of these former provinces basically of Ukraine. I don't know if they're called provinces. Oblasts, is that the proper word?
Yeah,
but these are the provinces or the oblasts where they had the referendum, right? And you know, people criticize that. I have no idea how legitimate of an election it was. I tend to think it was probably, you know, leaned towards, you know, reuniting with Russia, but I could be wrong about that. But anyways, the official result was that these regions voted to join with Russia, and Russia later accepted their bid, right? So they're technically part of Russia now, although that's currently being disputed militarily. But I mean, that's sort of the situation, right?
Yeah, exactly. And what's really again, what's very disturbing about this is that even these, let's make the assumption that these new incorporated territories, that it's legitimate, they are part of the Russian Federation. Almost all of them are still either partially or almost completely, in some cases, to a very great extent, controlled by the Ukrainian military, right? I mean, Donetsk is still basically surrounded by Ukrainian military. Like in Kherson, the capital city, Kherson, taken by the Ukrainians. Zaporozhye, also, there's Ukrainian military presence there. In fact, in the city of Zaporozhye, I believe, unless I'm really losing my mind, is actually controlled by the Ukrainians, like the city of Zaporozhye, right? So it's just,
yeah.
It's just, again, it's just a very, very bizarre situation. And on top of this, the Ukrainians have been shelling and making these sort of very brief incursions into Belgorod, which is Russian territory across the border from Ukraine. And the reason they've been able to do this is because the Russians just inexplicably pulled out of Kharkov in the north. And this was another very bizarre, like, there's just been just a series since basically some last summer. There's just been a series of, well, actually, not since last summer. I mean, from the very first weeks of this conflict, Russia has just been doing these bizarre so-called regroupings where, you know, they like surrounded Kiev and then regrouped. They were in Kharkov and then regrouped. They were in Kherson and then left without basically firing a shot. And it's just so bizarre. And I don't know if you've been following the drama with Prigozhin, the head of.
Yeah. Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that. You have a couple really good articles that people should check out that you've posted recently, including the one about Prigozhin, which I'll ask you about. But I just wanted to mention these other two. You have one, 39 questions about the war in Ukraine. And these are basically questions that is it literally called Angry Patriots Club? Like, that's the name of the organization?
It was started by Strelkov, who is this, you know, turbo patriot and
yeah.
group of sort of military veterans. And they just got together, started this club.
Okay. Well, they've been – see, and that's what I mean. Like, there have been there's some major criticism of Putin and of the Russian state's prosecution of the special military operation, especially from these, like, you know, sort of – far right, I don't even know if that's an accurate label, but they would probably be described as far right by the mass media, you know, by these more patriotic, nationalistic Russian figures. And they do, as you say in your article, I mean, they do raise a lot of really good points, like what is going on here? Why is, this conflict could be going much differently. And that's really the main thing that, am I pronouncing it correctly? Evgeny, I'm not even going to pretend to know how to pronounce Russian names. This guy that is the head of the Wagner Group, I'll let you pronounce his name since I don't seem to be able to. But he released a video that you highlight on your most recent blog post on Substack, where he's just laying into the Russian government and calling out all the bureaucrats in Moscow and how nobody's getting supplied, and they're like deliberately – he's almost making it seem like they're deliberately – sabotaging and undermining the war effort.
I think maybe you even are being I would think he's basically explicitly saying that, honestly.
Yeah.
In fact, he doesn't just, you know, what's so amazing about it is that he goes after Gerasimov and Shoigu like personally by name. In fact, he insults Shoigu's children, basically calling them libtard like YouTubers, you know, like it's an incredible, and he made various statements and they're all really incredible. And the reason why I think people shouldn't ignore this is because it's not just Prigozhin saying this stuff. Like, if you've been following this war not from the perspective of the sort of turbo patriots, the pro-military guys, the guys who think that Ukraine shouldn't exist, they have been screaming about basically incompetence and outright treachery in the Russian Ministry of Defense since the very first weeks of this conflict. And so you get a very, very different picture of what has transpired over the last year if you sort of turn off the English language YouTube and look at Russian language commentary, right? And so first might seem like totally out of the blue to a lot of people, which I totally get. But really what he's saying, I mean, the basic, his basic points is that the Russian Ministry of Defense is just a total basket case that probably a lot of it is probably sabotage. Another, a lot of it is also probably just total incompetence. It's completely corrupt. There's no proper chain of command. There's no real vision. There's no strategy. There's nothing, right? And this sounds blasphemous to many, I think, Westerners who have, you know, looked to Russia as this bastion of, you know, hope. And I totally get it, but it's actually nothing new. It's actually, it's nothing new if, you follow the Russian language, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's why I value your Substack, because you do follow it very closely and, you know, provide good transcripts of some of this stuff and just, you know, kind of fill in the details. And you're right. It does paint a totally different picture than what you'd hear from a guy like Gonzalo Lira, who I understand was just picked up by Ukrainian authorities, if I'm not mistaken. Is that right? I know he's he claimed to be picked up by him, you know, what was that, like about a year ago, I think, or maybe a little bit less than that. And then most recently, he was just also detained by Ukraine's Secret Service, apparently. Who knows what's going on with that? And, you know, I followed his coverage of the conflict in Ukraine from the very beginning, and I thought he had a lot of really intelligent things to say. But then you look at, you know, some of these Russian, like, patriotic groups, and they are painting a totally different story. And, I mean, I remember watching Gonzalo Lira on YouTube, and, I mean, he was claiming, you know, like, a year ago, like, in May of last year, that Russia was, like, on the verge of, like, totally conquering Ukraine. And look where we're at today, where they can't even maintain any of this territory. So that's what I mean. It's very difficult to sort of get to the bottom and really figure out what's going on. I mean, you know, you look at this guy that heads the Wagner Group, Prigozhin, and I mean, if this guy's saying this stuff about the Russian government, there's got to be something to it, right? I mean, he's not just making this stuff up.
Yeah, look, and also, first of all, I also don't want to romanticize Prigozhin. I mean, first of all, he's an ex-convict turned businessman. He's obviously a very shrewd businessman. He's very clearly an opportunist. So I don't want to paint him as some sort of altruistic angel. But there's no way to dismiss most of these claims just because, well, first of all, because many, many other people, by the way, people who don't even like Prigozhin, like Strelkov. Strelkov hates Prigozhin. But Strelkov is saying the same thing as Prigozhin, right? And secondly, I'm sorry, but all you have to do is just look at a map of, or just sort of remind yourself of what has happened over the last year. And I'm sorry, but Prigozhin's sort of version of events and assessment of the situation seems to be a much more fitting description of Russia's logistical and leadership capabilities than this idea that Moscow is running these sort of 5D circles around Washington. And I understand that that's painful for a lot of people because they've been told been given a very different narrative. But look, I mean, facts are facts. Anything, the mere fact that Russia hasn't even pushed the Ukrainians out of Donbass is frankly scandalous. And the problem is that anything that remains of Ukraine after this war is going to be a permanent anti-Russia, which, again, is what this special military operation was supposed to prevent. And yet you have basically guaranteed this conflict is going to be used to it's like baptism by fire for the Ukrainian nation. Like, if there wasn't already a Ukrainian identity, I guarantee it exists now. And it's also going to be a backbone of this state and ideology is going to be a vicious anti-Russia sentiment that I think decade get rid of in the best case scenario. So it really is tragic. And I also really, really urge people, like, don't look at it as if you really don't like Globo Homo or the globalists. Ukrainians are good people. Most of them are absolutely wonderful people. I've spent a little bit of time in Ukraine. My son is like 1/4 Ukrainian. They're wonderful people. Every Ukrainian that dies is a horrible tragedy. And the same with the Russians. And the victory for us normal, you know, proles, is when the Ukrainians and Russians stop killing each other and kill their oligarchs, in my opinion.
Yeah.
And so, like, the war itself is a tragedy. And unfortunately, again, I hate to be a party pooper, I don't know if there's actually, you know, it's possible for both sides to lose a war. That's happened many times throughout history. And that's my greatest fear, is that at this point, I don't think there's any going back. I think that it's been devastating for a lot of, I mean, it's devastated. First of all, it's destroyed any idea of sort of Slavic, pan-Slavic unity, or creating some sort of Slavic front against sort of Western degeneracy. That's all gone forever, basically, unless something, some sort of enormous shift in Russia's fortunes, you know, takes place. So it really is a very, very terrible tragedy. I really do regret that this conflict didn't end quickly and bloodlessly. And I don't know, like, how normal people are going to get out, how us normal people are going to get a W on this one. And I feel really bad for the Ukrainians. I feel really bad for the Russians. It just sucks.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I know. The more I hear from, you know, all sides, you know, the more you're right. I mean, it really is just that there's no winners in this situation. And, you know, I wanted to actually ask you about the Duran, for example. I know you sort of leveled a little bit of criticism towards them, you know, when they did that. They actually did a whole video about this, you know, covering the Wagner leader's video. Yeah, and it's like they didn't even really, like, address what he was actually saying. So it's like, and I guess it's sort of like a broader question, like just the media's coverage in general of what's going on over there. Certainly the mainstream media has just, it's just a one side, Russia bad, Ukraine good, you know, we're standing for democracy and we're standing up to this evil tyrant, you know, Vladimir Putin. But then you look at, like, the more alternative media, like the Duran, for example, and I think they do great work. I listen to, like, pretty much all their podcasts, at least, you know, the ones that come out on their RSS audio feed. And they got a lot of – they're two very, very intelligent guys. They have a lot of intelligent guests on there. I'd love to hear you on there, by the way. I don't know if we could maybe try to make that happen, but it would be cool to hear you on there to present, you know, a sort of different perspective. Because, you know, you listen to them and it's like, you know, sort of like with – like I was mentioning with Gonzalo Lira, like they have their sort of their sort of narrative of the situation, and it's like Russia's just on the cusp of you know, declaring victory over Ukraine, but that's just really not the case.
Yeah, it's not the case at all. And in fact, I remember I have the screenshot saved somewhere on my computer, but there was this one Duran YouTube headline that was like Bakhmut surrounded, and it was from like 7 months ago, you know. And there is this, and look, okay, you know, this is sort of inevitable in online punditry, where maybe people get a little bit ahead of themselves. Like, I get it, and it's certainly nothing unique to the Duran. And but my point is, though, is that I do feel like there is this tendency, again, not specific to the Duran, where because so many, I mean, look, basically, this is how I see it. A lot of people who present themselves as Russia experts don't actually talk about Russia so much. They don't even know that much about Russia. It's more that they hate the West, which I get and I sympathize with as a Westerner. And so they project this hatred. And so what they do is that they, because they hate the West, then obviously Moscow, which has beef with the West, must be a beacon of hope and the opposite of the West. But when you get into the nitty gritty of it, and this is something, by the way, that took me a long time. I mean, I lived in Russia for many years when it finally clicked with me during COVID. I mean, the parallels between the power system in Moscow and Washington really aren't that different at the end of the day. And yes, there are some differences, but really when you get down to the, you know, the at the foundational level, They're both run by sleazy oligarchs who don't care at all about average people and will do anything to consolidate and keep their power and wealth. And and so, look, like, I just really urge people. It's not about, and obviously, I mean, if anyone reads my blog, you'll know that my criticisms of Russia are nothing like what the criticisms leveled by CNN. You know, they're very different. It's more about, look, I want the best for the Russian people, and I think the Russian government is really fucking up, you know? And so it's just like, the problem with a lot of this English language punditry is that they can never talk, it can never just be about Russia. Everything has to be put in this frame of, like, it's all about how bad the West is and how Russia is somehow this foil to the evil West. And I would just love to see some commentary where people just do a deep dive on Russia in itself and talk about the nuances going on inside this country. And like with this Prigozhin video, it's just very frustrating because this guy makes so many important points that are important for Westerners to understand, and they won't even touch it. They just say, oh, he's like really stressed out. And this is part of the problem. And you know what also I'll say? I do feel like because this very sort of this very sort of black and white narrative that's being presented, there's really no, how do you backpedal from that, right? Like, if you're in the Duran shoes, how do you suddenly come out and say, oh, by the way, I know that we've been talking about imminent victory for the last year, but actually it's really complicated, it's really dirty, there's a lot of corruption. I mean, there's no way they can do that. Their viewers would mutiny. And look, I mean, I'm sorry, but as someone who's been in the media for a long time and someone who's living on, you know, Substack starving wages, I know it firsthand. It's really hard to get people to give you money. And once you get it, you don't want to lose it. And so, you know, what inevitably ends up happening is that if you don't tell people what they want to hear, they pull their money and they go to someone who will give them the, you know, self-soothing lies, basically, let's put it that way. And so it's in that way, it is sort of it's a very cynical media space in my personal opinion.
Yeah, no, I hear you. I think all the points you've made are entirely legitimate and valid. And that's not to say that the Duran and other, you know, podcasts of that genre do great work. They obviously do a lot of really good work, but it's just getting increasingly harder and harder to sort of connect all the dots and maintain this narrative that Russia is on the verge of victory when there's just clearly so many problems, you know, that are on full display, especially if you follow, you know, like the insider baseball with what's going on over there and some of these, you know, like the Wagner Group, for example, which, by the way, I do have a question about that kind of more generally. I know we're about out of time here, but does this Wagner Group, it's a private military contractor, do they get paid directly by the Russian government to go and like fight in these conflicts, or like how does that work exactly? Do you know?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I don't actually know how it works financially. I would assume that they are given contracts by the Ministry of Defense, but because they also receive weapons from, well, they're supposed to receive.
Well, that's one of his big criticisms, is they're not getting supplies, they're not getting ammunition, you know, yeah, that sort of thing. So.
Drama.
Yeah. Well, interesting. I'll tell you what, man, we're going to have to go ahead and wrap up. But yeah, I would highly encourage everybody to check out your Substack and definitely follow it, support your work. You know, you're doing you really got a very unique take on a lot of this stuff, one that I think deserves a much, much wider audience. So I hope people go check out your page and support your work and follow what you're doing over there, because you're not gonna get these sorts of ideas and takes anywhere else. That's for sure. I'll tell you that right now.
I really appreciate that, man. It was really fun talking. We should do it again.
Yeah, definitely. I'll stay in touch, and yeah, we can do this again in the future. There's tons of other topics I'm sure that we could get into. So, thanks for joining me, Riley. I appreciate it. Stay safe over there in Georgia, and keep up the great work. And I'll talk to you soon.
Awesome. Yep. Thanks again.
Okay. Take care, man.